Welcome back, and we'll proceed to the second panel of the day. If we could get our colleagues at the back to close the door so the foreign policy people don't overwhelm the panelists, we can quiet things down. Good. Yeah. Thanks very much. My name is John Page. I'm a senior fellow here in the Global Economy and Development Program at Brookings. It's my pleasant duty to be the moderator for today's panel. I guess one way to characterize the previous panel was these are the immediate stakeholders. These are the folks who have a dog in the fight, if you will. This panel is people who've been there, done that, and moved on. And that's, I think, an interesting perspective. What we talked a lot about earlier today was seeing AGOA through the lens of developing business, developing commerce, and ultimately developing Africa. And that, of course, for those of us who are interested in African growth and change, is perhaps the most important ultimate objective of any international agreement. How we should do that in the details, I think there was a good deal of discussion this morning, and there will continue to be a good deal of discussion. This panel, I think, brings to the debate a slightly different point of view. These are all people, as I'll explain in a moment, who have had a stake in government and in U.S. economic policy towards Africa at one point in their career, but have now moved on to business and civil society. And so they bring a rather unique combination of interests and experiences to bear on the question of what should business, civil society, other interested stakeholders beyond those who are immediately in the negotiation and the development of AGOA bring, expect, and hopefully do to change or to strengthen AGOA to the benefit of African growth. And that's about all I'll say because we had the beginnings of an extraordinarily lively discussion in the holding room, so I know the panelists have a lot to say. But I just wanted to introduce each one of them. You have a bio with perhaps three short sentences. To my immediate right is Katrine Curlman, who is a professor at the Georgetown School of Law. She's a lawyer, and a trade lawyer, I would assume. But at the moment, she's a senior fellow and director of the Transform Africa Policy Network at the Aspen Institute. She has served with the Office of the U.S. Special Trade Representative, so that's her government experience, and she now, of course, is both an analyst and an advisor on these issues to a much wider spectrum of business and non-governmental organizations. Rosa Whitaker was the first Assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Africa. She's in some sense the creator of the position and has again moved to a role in the private sector, advising business and civil society. She's also deeply active herself in non-governmental organizations dealing with Africa, and so brings to us both a business and NGO perspective. Finally, Whitney Schneiderman is the president of Schneiderman & Associates. He is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the Clinton administration. So in a sense, looking at development and growth in Africa from the foreign policy as opposed to the trade policy side. And I've been on several panels with Whitney. He has a broad range of views and an engaging style of presenting them as one thinks about economic development and business opportunities in Africa. So a highly qualified panel. As I said, my duty is basically to be quiet, keep a little bit of time, and perhaps ask a question at the end. So we've asked each of the panelists to give us about 10 minutes worth of remarks, and I'll begin on my right with Katrine.
Thank you very, very much. I'm delighted to be here, and thanks especially to Brookings and the Corporate Council, and I'm happy to be on this distinguished panel with colleagues I've worked with over the years. I have long been an advocate of the preference programs. I've worked a lot with them, both when I was at USTR, going through the nuts and bolts of them and helping countries comply with their eligibility requirements. And then since I left USTR and have been in the nonprofit sector now for a number of years, I've worked with and led coalitions to very comprehensively look at how they should be reformed. And while I think that they're an important part of our policy, I do think it's time for a new approach. I think it's time for some new thinking. based more on a different type of partnership between the United States and Africa. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what that needs to involve. I think we all need to do more thinking on exactly how it should work in operation, but I want to at least lay out a couple of key elements to that. And to give a little bit of context for my remarks, too, I want to share just a bit about Transform Africa, which is the initiative that I'm working with through the Aspen Institute, with colleagues here and in Africa and in Europe. Obviously, my comments will focus on agriculture, but a lot of what I'm going to say applies to other sectors as well, so it's not limited to agriculture specifically. But I think agriculture is Africa's sort of the last great frontier on agriculture, and I also think that this is where AGOA needs some particular fresh thinking. So I will focus a bit on agriculture as I speak this morning. Our mission at Transform Africa is to spur agricultural development around regional corridors. I'll say more about those in a few minutes. In sub-Saharan Africa, in ways that bring smallholder farmers into a dynamic, commercially driven, agricultural, and broader regional market. We really have two components to our work, and we created this initiative because we saw gaps in the market. One of them is investment itself. And what we call the missing middle of agriculture, but what it really is the connective tissue between the large number of smallholder farmers and the commercial enterprises, and bringing smallholder farmers into commercial systems, which is something that we feel very, very strongly about, doing it in a way that gives something back to the smallholder farmers, but doesn't expect that everybody is going to be necessarily engaged in international trade, which I think is one of the things that we've sort of stumbled around with sometimes when we talk about AGOA. How do you deal with the large number of producers who are outside of the market? And so we are thinking about how you can make those connections to the market in innovative ways. So investment is one side, and the other side is a new approach on policy, and that's really what I'll talk mainly about today, working from the ground up instead of from the top down, and removing concrete barriers to investment. We have a pilot investment in Tanzania in a farm called Matanga Farms. It's a Tanzanian company. It's a mixed farming enterprise that saw potential in seed potato production but didn't have the capital to do it, and also, as we encountered right away, faced very specific barriers in the market. And we yesterday was an announcement that you may have seen that Tony Elamelu, the chairman of Ayres Holding from Nigeria, has invested now in this enterprise with us, and this is the first of this kind. It's the first social enterprise investment that crosses borders, so we're really excited about that, and I think that there's sort of signals that there's sort of a whole new wave of thinking about these things. I'm not an investment person, as you probably can tell from my background, but I think it's been fascinating for me as a trade lawyer and a policy person to work with the investment side of things. We've really learned a lot from each other, and I think that's one of the things that I want to highlight this morning, too. We've got to really find a way to kind of cross some of these barriers a little bit more, whether it's within the government or those of us who are on the outside working on these things. So our approach is to create a demonstration effect in the market, deliver commercial results, and deliver real development benefits. Now, so how does this all translate back into policy? First, I think we need to start at the investment level instead of the 10,000-foot level, and I think that's been one of the challenges we've had with programs like AGOA. It's designed very well, but it doesn't necessarily trickle down to the producers on the ground, and we need to, I think, flip our equation more and start going from the ground up. This is what I would call demand-driven trade policy, and it's the demand needs to exist both in the market itself, so that, like the case that I mentioned on seed potatoes, there's a real demand in the market to produce something, but it also needs to be the demand of the producers and the companies and what they need in order to be able to survive in the market. And the objective is to find those specific obstacles and remove them, which we did through this team of investment bankers and who would have thought, and trade lawyers, and also agricultural experts who could really go in and identify the specific issues on seed technology and, you know, what we needed to know to be able to bring in mini tubers from Kenya to plant them in Tanzania and get a new variety approved in Tanzania. Part of what we learned from this, too, is that despite having laws in place and regional agreements even that covered some of these things, the system wasn't being tested. Business wasn't testing the system. And so although you had great things on paper, they weren't working. So I think that really needs to be a big part of this, too, is how do we make sure that that everything that we negotiate is being tested and coming alive. U.S. and African governments have a clear role to play in making sure that these investment opportunities can succeed. One thing is a real partnership with the private sector in a systemic and sustainable way as part of looking at very specific challenges and how to solve them. one thing that we really advocate strongly for is partnering with African business, obviously, with governments, with institutions, to learn more about where this untapped potential is and to remove these specific barriers. And a holistic approach, as I mentioned, is really, I think, a big part of this. Right now, there's all this talk about reorganizing the government and consolidating. And I think that what we need to do instead is actually really foster the expertise that's there and encourage that there's much more work being done across expertise so that we can come up with solutions that are really addressing problems. So it's not, the idea is not to mush everything together, but to try to find ways to use the expertise that we have at agencies like USTR and OPIC, Export-Import Bank, TDA. We have a lot of great resources. And there have been some really good proposals on how to do that, which I won't go into, but the Corporate Council has some great proposals. A number of folks in the room have come up with some very specific things on how to do that kind of coordination. So I think we need to bring that to the center of the discussion again. I mentioned at the beginning that our approach is very regional, and I think that while markets matter at all levels, they really matter at the regional level in Africa. That is, without regional markets that function, we're not going to be able to figure out how to increase trade between the United States and Africa. So we need to figure out a way to get our policies to focus a bit more on the regional side. We all know what the gaps are. They're on the infrastructure side, they're on the supply side, distribution, storage capacity, processing. The policy infrastructure and the institutions, as I said before, are also still being developed and tested. And we all know this and have seen this firsthand. But despite the many regional agreements, it's not working as well as it needs to be on the ground. So one of the things that we think is a way to address that is by putting some support behind the development corridors, which is an African movement and an African-born solution that came really first from Nelson Mandela in South Africa but has spread throughout the continent. And what's nice about the development corridors is that they follow market pathways and not political boundaries. And the other thing that's great about the corridors is that if done in the right way, that trunk infrastructure that's been built already to connect mines with ports can really be used to develop a whole system to bring in agricultural producers, to bring in other producers, so that you have this whole flourishing regional market. Obviously, that's going to take resources. That's going to take a lot more attention from all of us. But it's a model that's out there that really holds, I think, a tremendous amount of promise. The corridors are in varying stages of development. They need different things. There's also a lot of discussion about how to do governance on the corridors, and I think that that's something that we need to look at very, very seriously, too. So we need to somehow figure out how to work the regional aspect more into our international policies. And on the international side, the international market matters as well. Farmers make decisions, and other producers the same, looking at the market all the way up from the local level up to the international level. And one of the things that we've had a challenge with, I think, on agriculture in particular with AGOA is that we do still have restrictions in the market. We have tariff rate quotas. This came up a little bit this morning. I won't say too much because that's a lengthy discussion in and of itself, but there are products like sugar that are very, very, that hold a lot of potential for a lot of countries that are very, very limited still, and we need to think seriously about that. Whether it's politically challenging or not, we need to think seriously about it if we're serious about making this work. We need to provide assistance on navigating very complex rules on sanitary and phytosanitary measures. We need to also, again, find solutions that link back to the investment and that are regional. And one thing that I do want to just mention briefly, I think I'm about out of time, right? Am I out of time?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, perfect. I want to mention the economic partnership agreements. I heard them come up at the end of the last panel. And, you know, I think that we really need to be cautious in this because seeing that there's an alternative model out there, I think the tendency is to say, let's just move to that. We need to think very carefully about what the alternative model is if we are going to go down that path. And the economic partnerships are not the right model for doing this. They were an attempt to link trade and development, but the problem with them, though, when looking at them much more closely, which I've had the great pleasure of doing, is that they discourage regional trade rather than really building it up. There are various reasons for that in the way that they're designed, but they have caused countries to try to block certain parts of trade so that if you look at how they all match up, the regional trade is really thwarted over the long term, and they don't allow for enough accumulation, as trade lawyers would, you know, say, but value-added production going across borders. When I asked somebody about this, one of the negotiators, the response was, well, there's not much of that happening now. And to me, that signals that you know, why are we locking ourselves into something that's not going to provide a way forward for the future? That is not the answer. And I was really discouraged by that. So I think that we just need to be incredibly careful. And I don't think that that's the model that we want. Moving towards more bilateral trade, figuring out how to really remove barriers on the ground, I think is absolutely where we need to take things. But we need to find a way to do it that's going to leave open the potential for the future, that's going to allow investments like this farm that I'm talking about in Tanzania. And there are many, many more of those. And I think we need to talk a lot more about what they are and what makes them work or doesn't work and where some of these barriers come in. But we need to find a way to really encourage those opportunities that nobody's been talking about yet to come to the table and make sure that we're paving the way for the future. So I think there are some, you know, other specific things we can talk about. I'm going to leave it at that and look forward to the Q&A and to continuing this discussion with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Katrine. And I might have even given you an extra 2 minutes to talk about the EPAs. It's something we need to talk about a great deal. Now let me turn to Rosa and ask you again for about 10 minutes worth of remarks. Thanks.
Well, let me just agree with you on the EPAs.
But
I want to just thank Brookings and also especially Wanji Kiminye, and thank you, John, for moderating this discussion. And I'm pleased to be here with so many fellow stakeholders and panelists who have been working on the front lines to advance this policy, U.S. policy towards Africa. I like the title that you've chosen here, the role of non-governmental and private sector stakeholders in this. Because when we look at the birth of AGOA, and I think that there are a few of us who were there at the birth, at conception to enactment, it was not conceived, nor was it birthed in government. It came from a group of committed external stakeholders, really. If we look back, you know, I remember the narrative, some of the thinking started in the 1994, 1995. And that was at the time when the GATT was becoming the WTO. And that's when people started asking, okay, in this new global framework for trade, where will Africa be? And although there was a consensus around the need to integrate Africa into the global economy, I mean, in terms of if we want to talk about rhetoric, everyone said they supported it, but activity around how to do it was missing. The Europeans, as many know, they had their own framework. And so there were a few of us that started beginning to think about how the U.S. might engage more productively. And I, at the time, was a career diplomat serving in Cote d'Ivoire, and I remember receiving a démarche request from the State Department that I had to go in and sell the WTO accession to the Ivorian government. And I began to look. I was also responsible for the cocoa and coffee sectors, and I began to realize that I really didn't have the leverage to do so. There wasn't a compelling why they had to join this framework, because they were, Cote d'Ivoire, like many other, and this is when Cote d'Ivoire was functioning in 1993, 94. But the African countries were so marginalized in this whole process of trade. And at the time, you know, when you're on the ground, you start noticing things. I noticed being responsible for the coffee and cocoa sectors that, in terms of U.S. policy, Cote d'Ivoire could export raw beans, raw coffee, cocoa beans. But as soon as they added value, they would hit trade tariff escalation, trade peaks in the U.S. Yet we said we wanted to integrate them. And so, you know, I was conflicted because I felt like in many ways my own government was giving me a script that I couldn't read. And as I began to dig deep and question some of these things, I was, prior to serving in Cote d'Ivoire, I was the biggest fan of the PL480 program. Until you start to talk to farmers on the ground and say, well, why aren't you selling? Why aren't you productive? And you realize that PL480 was actually serving as a perverse disincentive for that productive activity. As much as we wanted to say, oh, the government can sell the money and use the money for development, it was really not in, there was not a mutuality of benefits, because really what we were effectively doing was dumping, you know, U.S. products onto the African market, which was making the farmers uncompetitive. And so this is, and when I looked at how the tariff peaks and tariff escalation, this just ran counter to everything I've learned about economic development. And I wasn't the only one. I mean, there were, you know, there were other people thinking about this. I remember when Mike Williams came to Cote d'Ivoire, he was chief of staff to Congressman McDermott. He started thinking about it. And so I think we started planning. There were the Africans certainly were cognizant that something was wrong in this relationship. I saw one failed aid project after another. I saw, you know, $500,000 studies. And those aid that whole trajectory to aid, and it was never. I am not for aid or trade. I think we need a comprehensive approach. Africa needs smart aid and trade, but trade has aid has largely failed, and I don't see a lot of people talking about that because they depend on the largesse of the trade system. Most of the people will not criticize aid. I guarantee they're getting money from AID. And that's just the truth. And they're not going to cut off their lifeline. But what we have with the aid system, we don't have smart aid. I was in Congress all week talking about this. What we have is an aid industrial complex. And a lot of people who are talking about are part of it. And a lot of my friends that are liberals are part of it. And I have asked the members of Congress to ask GSA to do a study on how much of that aid hits the ground. And how much it has gone into a network of NGOs and ancillary activities that are not effective. And what is the impact of that doing in Africa? How can you have an NGO having more money than a ministry? And it's not just enough to say, well, these African governments are corrupt. Well, let's deal with the corruption. I agree with Paul Collier. Send the auditors in with the aid money. But let's make sure more hits the ground. I have sat through more of these AID-sponsored seminars where the people that they were teaching on the ground knew more than the people given the lectures. And you know what I spent a lot of time in the, you know what they're saying about the U.S. policy now, most of the Africans, they say you get lectured for less. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're moving to China. I just saw a project. I'm bombarded with it all the time. You know, now they're talking about, there's an initiative, I won't mention the donors because I don't want to seem defensive or like I'm an angry black woman, but it's not anger, it's just some, I think it's just some passion and righteous indignation, if I would say. But no, I mean, I was sitting in Ghana and there's this initiative that's being funded by the U.S. government, and they're talking about rice sufficiency. And that's true, that makes sense, you know. Ghanaians and Africans eat a lot of rice. They should be self-sufficient. So what do they do for the solution? So then these same groups will go up in Congress and AID will say, we have invested this money in making Africans more self-sufficient in rice production. And so I wanted to dig deep. I said, let me see what this is. And what it was some AID consultants giving a lecture to some rice farmers that have been farming rice for generations. And the problem is not education, it's irrigation. It's irrigation problem. So why can't AID invest that money into irrigation? And there's these farmers are sitting there having to suffer through all of this rhetoric. And I'm sorry, when I first moved to Africa, the people who were involved in aid work, they were like missionaries. They were living sacrificially. Now we see these AID consultants and World Bank, they're living larger than life, expounding some perverse incentives, sucking up the local capacity. It's just not right. So I'm just asking all people who have a little bit of courage and not afraid about your money being cut off to really get on this and study it. And if I'm lying, I mean, prove me wrong. I want to be provocative so someone can probably give somebody another report to do to say it's not true. But this saying to this, you know, you see these things, and coalitions are usually birthed out of a burden. And when I was in Cote d'Ivoire, and there were many of us, we had a burden to do something about this. And I want to say that there were only about 5 to 10 of us. Five Americans and 5 Africans. And we said, you know what, we're going to do something. We started looking at aid. at that time, it was about $30 billion of U.S. aid, and we could not see hardly an impact on the ground. And the lesson I want to say is that a small group of committed people can get tough things done. I said years ago, I don't know anybody in this town that cannot be rolled. I mean, we started AGOA at a time where it was not politically feasible to do so. People said NAFTA was a failure. They didn't want to hear about trade. It took 5 years to pass. And that's the only reason people say, well, why do you, Rosa, get so much credit for AGOA? There were others. And I think as a lot of times, and I give those others credit, it was not one person's idea. But I think that I just probably had the tenacity to last from day one to the end, where I think some others just said, you know, this isn't worth it. But before we set out to convince people, and I think that's where I want to come to now, you know, we have to have a compelling why, a compelling what, and a compelling who. And that's what we did. That's the foundation of coalition. And I can tell you, with the Obama administration, there will not be a robust Africa policy unless people in this room and others decide as external stakeholders. Fortunately, during the time of AGOA, we didn't have that many USAID contractors. So now we got so many USAID contractors in the advocacy community that they can't advocate, and they're scared. And also, we have people in government, like myself, who knew we weren't going to retire there. I was in government at a time, I can say so now, that the U.S. Trade Representative was not supportive of AGOA. And I had to work it externally. I had remember letters saying that I cared more about African jobs than I did American jobs. There was a move against my job by some people in this room. And I just said, you know what, really? I really believe so strong, and this is not about I, but I'm just saying you have to believe in something. You have to be willing to fight for something bigger than yourselves. And my view is that if you're not going to fight for it, then just stop talking about it, because nothing is going to happen. That's why I don't do these kind of things anymore. But when I saw the people, I said, you know, Brookings may be able to be a little different, because I find that the talk shops were getting very disturbing. If talks doesn't lead to, the Obama administration isn't going to do anything, I can tell you. But the Clinton administration wasn't prepared to do anything. We force activity. And Obama administration is more harder because we have a popular African-American president, and the African-American and the liberals are giving him a pass on Africa. Even the Africans are giving him a pass. I mean, I was with the African minister yesterday, said, well, we think if he gets a second term and, you know, maybe because they think he's African, that's all excuses. Leadership is leadership. Courage is courage. I supported the president. I knew him before he became president. But I do believe he's overwhelmed. And if he's going to do something, we have to create the political space for him to do it by having an external coalition. So I think that private sector and NGOs can be essential in mobilizing these forward-thinking policies. And I think we also have to be very careful, because I see a strategy going on. Everybody's talking about AGOA for what it's not doing. Everybody's talking about AGOA for what it's not doing, even the administration. Because that, of course, if you can convince people that it's not working, what it's not doing, it makes it easier to not support it. But AGOA was never designed to be a panacea. Why do we have to say AGOA or food security, AGOA or bottom ground level strategies? Africa is a complex development challenge. You need a comprehensive approach. So it shouldn't be AGOA. AGOA didn't do this. AGOA did. I was amazed, because according to the GSA, and I'm still waiting for the U.S. government to tell us what AGOA costs, but the only report that we have from the GSA says AGOA costs about $2 million a year. So you wanted to end all this poverty, change the pay paradigm. You wanted the oil pattern to change for $2 million a year. Now, what do you expect for $2 million? I would line it up against any AID initiative. That we have donors that spend $1 million, $2 million on a study. And what is AGOA done? Our trade has increased exponentially. We have birthed some new industries. If it was working in one country for $2 million, it would be worth it. We got 300,000 jobs. We got, 40,000 women working over $300 million in exports in the garment sector. We birthed the garment sector in several African countries. We have developed a whole transport sector, Mercedes-Benz, Daimler Chrysler. We have people working. So it seems to me, instead of, oh, but it's not, it didn't do anything for the environment. Oh, there's still some poor people in Benin. What do you want for $2 million? $3 million? $10 million? Okay, if I'm wrong, it doesn't work that way. So I think what we ought to do is look at what's working and build on what's working. So I don't buy this, oh, it didn't do this, it's fallen short. Yes, it's fallen short because it's not everything. How come when we talk about other regions of the world, we talk about multiple policies, multiple projects, but when it's a AGOA, everything has to be a AGOA? No, we need to build more trade capacity. That doesn't necessarily have to be a AGOA. Let's build that trade capacity. We need more regional integration. We can build it into a AGOA or outside of a AGOA, but that does not take away from what has worked. And so I want to just debunk this notion of an either or. We don't treat any other region of the world like that, and we shouldn't treat AGOA like that. When I look at cut flowers from Kenya growing by 11,000%, you go tell those women that's working in Lesotho, that now in factories, that are working for a living wage, that now have other initiatives like clinics, medical clinics, where they can get their HIV AIDS treatment, that AGOA is insignificant. And so, and all this whole thing about reinventing the wheels and all of this, I mean, it's just, you don't have to always reinvent. You got to build on what's working and expand. And unfortunately, it's just become, it's just become fashionable. And I think it's become fashionable because if the administration and others can say AGOA isn't working, then that extricates them from doing anything. It extricates them from expanding it, from renewing it. We have a lot of misinformation. We have to organize ourselves. As we speak, AGOA, we got that provision of AGOA that's much talked about, that's about to expire. I don't see any strong advocacy. The administration's response has been lukewarm at best. Nobody's, pressing them about it. And if nobody cares, why should Congress care? And it will put probably about 100,000 women out of work, more than that, if a little provision, third country fabric, is not extended. So I was a bit concerned when I saw in March, early March, the whole fanfare about International Women's Day. I was happy that, First Lady Michelle Obama and Secretary Clinton, International Women's Day, but and this whole African Entrepreneurs Conference. This, in my view, is substance, style masquerading as substance. And let's just call it, I'm a Democrat. I love, the rhetoric. I love the attention. But it's the external parties that hold people accountable. And I don't care what party they're from. I would say, we, as a Democrat, I was working for Congressman Rangel. We bought Newt Gingrich in. We bought the Republicans in. Our message was, if you think trade is good for everybody in the world, why isn't it good for Africa? With the Democrats, we said, you supposedly care about Africa, let's have a trade investment center. We got to reach across the aisle. But unless you are willing to do something externally, there nothing will happen. And we have to get aligned. And I want to just spend the next few minutes just talking on, just to giving you a snapshot of how much time am I over? Okay, I will sum up in 1 minute. I don't get out too often. I will sum up in 1 minute what we need to do. This whole thing about whether AGOA should be permanent, that's not, we just need to make it certain. So whether that point of certainty is 15 years, 10 years, we need to just make sure it's certain. And we also need to just stop pulling the plug. You see how the administration pulled the plug on Madagascar. We now have 50,000 people out of work. And why? They said because of the government. What did those women have to do with the fact that a coup leader took over? And what is the best way to deal with a coup leader except for having people that are economically viable, able to send their kids to school? And it was done, and I didn't hear anything from the stakeholders. And it was just a pass. And you should go see. They were up to $300 million in exports, 50,000 people out of work like that, and nothing happened. So we need to do – I'm also asking for tax incentives for U.S. company. It will help us to build a constituency here for those that invest in projects in Africa, infrastructure, regional projects with a big development gain. Not minerals, not oil, but if you do a project with a development gain, you can get a tax incentive. I have some other ideas, but I don't have time. But I will say this. You know, we always grew up with a saying that it said, it's never too late. It's never too late. But Martin Luther King, he corrected that, and he was right. He said, in life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. And there is. And I think if we don't do something now, and if we don't get bold, and if some of you AID contractors are not willing to, you know, lose some money, we will be too late. Thank you.
Well, passionate, committed, and maybe just a little bit angry?
Maybe.
Whitney, you have a tough act to follow.
Indeed. I think instead of my remarks, we should go march on the White House.
Yeah,
just kidding. No, let me add my thanks to Brookings and CCA for pulling this together. And where, you know, I can certainly say that I share Rosa's sense of urgency. There's no question about it. I think this is one of the most compelling issues is economic development in Africa. And much progress has been made, but more has to be made much more quickly. Let me just direct some of my remarks more specifically to AGOA, and let me start with Ron Brown, because it was 15 years ago this month that Ron Brown, as Secretary of Commerce, perished in a plane crash while on a trade mission in Croatia. Now, I bring this up not only because Ron Brown was a friend and someone I admired, but he was among the first American officials to understand that the African market was important to the United States. He understood that the African market was a vital engine of economic development, job creation, and innovation, and that it was to the benefit of Africa and the U.S. to strengthen that engine, principally through trade and investment, not so much aid. It was Ron Brown who said that the U.S. would not cede the African market to any other nation. It had too much potential. It was too significant. And because of Ron's vision and the work of Representatives Rangel, Payne, McDermott, Royce, Rosa, Mike Williams, the African Diplomatic Corps, which played a very special role, and many others, the U.S. moved away from its welfare approach to Africa to one that emphasized trade, investment, and competitiveness. And it was this new approach that was embodied in the African Growth and Opportunity Act that was signed into law in 2000 by President Clinton. But since then, much has changed. There is now a consumer class in Africa that exceeds India in its size and purchasing power. The once dark continent is now illuminated with diversified economies that are attracting investment in retail, finance, agriculture, telecommunications, mobile banking, manufacturing, infrastructure, to name several sectors. And according to Steve Radelet, who's chief economist at USAID and author of Emerging Africa, 17 African countries have achieved steady economic growth, more democracy, stronger leadership, and falling poverty rates over the last 15 years. And there are 6 additional countries poised to join this group. It's important to realize that over the next 10 years, the IMF forecasts that 7 of the 10 fastest-growing economies in the world will be in sub-Saharan Africa. And these countries are Ethiopia, Mozambique, Tanzania, Congo, Ghana, Zambia, and Nigeria, only 2 of which are oil exporters. The Economist anticipates that over the next 5 years, the average economy will outpace its Asian counterpart. Now, clearly, this is not my mother and my father's Africa, and this fact has been recognized by key actors in the global economy. In 2009, China overtook the U.S. to become Africa's largest trading partner. Trade between Africa and China is projected to almost triple from current levels to $300 billion by 2015. We can discuss the merits of China. That's not my point right now, Chinese investment. But the European Union as well has sought to enhance its position in Africa. And both Katrine and Rosa have referred to the economic partnership agreements that are being negotiated with virtually every country on the continent. These EPAs are controversial, for a number of reasons that have already been expressed, but from my point of view, is that they give companies from the EU preferential access to the African market at the disadvantage of American companies. We need, therefore, to keep our compass firmly set on Ron Brown's vision of close commercial relations with Africa, but we have much work to do. After all, there has not been a visit to sub-Saharan Africa by a U.S. Commerce Secretary in 10 years. For the last 12 years, the U.S. has had a Presidential Trade Development Capacity Initiative to enhance competitiveness and trade on the continent. USAID terminated this initiative last September. Given the budget crush, the Commerce Department has indicated it will close the Foreign Commercial Service offices in Dakar and Accra instead of reprogramming slots from more traditional markets such as in Europe. Now, AGOA, in my view, has plateaued in terms of its impact on U.S.-African trade. Three-quarters of U.S.-Africa trade is with five countries on the continent. Last year, we imported about $80 billion worth of goods. As Flory Lizer pointed out this morning, only $4 billion were non-traditional products, which was what AGOA was designed to stimulate, and we need to do more in that area. But the reality is that only 50 of AGOA's 6,500 product lines that provide duty-free, quota-free access have been utilized over the last 10 years, and we have to do much better there. And in February, I was listening to Ambassador Ron Kirk deliver his 2011 trade strategy to Congress, and I was hoping to learn the administration's position on extending both third-country fabric and the extension of AGOA. However, I was disconcerted that there was no mention of AGOA or Africa. And I think this is troubling. So let me offer a few ideas from the U.S. side of the ledger that might help to move us forward. President Obama should be applauded for convening a town hall meeting last August with Africa's youth leaders. But I think he should be encouraged to convene a carefully structured summit with Africa's current leaders to discuss U.S. goals and objectives on the continent. And this is not about a photo op. I'll give one example. When we were rolling out AGOA in the Clinton administration, we had all these feverish meetings, and it was decided initially that there would be 10 countries that would be original AGOA beneficiaries. So we called in the African Diplomatic Corps, told them about our great announcement, and they got really upset. How can you do this? This is supposed to be about Africa. We went back, we did our homework, and we realized we didn't get it. And not only we did not get it in trade, but we didn't get it in other areas. So that led to the first ever U.S.-Africa ministerial, where we invited trade ministers, finance ministers, and foreign ministers to the U.S. for 2 days of consultations. And it led to a much more broad-based policy and 38 African countries being included in the rollout of AGOA. So I think these summits can be extremely important. Second, we have to build on what AGOA has accomplished and begin to transition, in my view, from non-reciprocal to reciprocal trade. If the EU can negotiate free market agreements in Africa, I think we should give careful thought about doing that. However, there are profound economic asymmetries, and these reciprocal trade agreements should be phased in over time. But there's no question that as the African market matures, so must our trade relations. And focusing on regional markets and regional integration should be a priority. And we may want to start by negotiating a free trade agreement with the 130 million person common market of East Africa. But of course, we can't leave out the other regions as well. Third, we need to encourage more American companies to invest in Africa. It is good for the U.S. and it's good for the continent. Yet given that only 1% of American companies export outside the U.S. and that the African market is at best an afterthought for most American companies, we should provide U.S. companies with commercial incentives to do business in the region. And I think we have an opportunity as the Obama administration contemplates corporate tax reform. It should be encouraged, as Rosa suggested, to drop to zero the tax on repatriated income from investments by U.S. companies in AGOA-eligible countries outside the extractive sectors. Finally, Africa can play an important role in the president's National Export Initiative. Currently, the U.S. exports $17 billion worth of goods and services to the continent. This supports about 100,000 jobs in the United States. We should seek to double the number of U.S. jobs created through exports to Africa by 2015. And a good way to jumpstart the process would be for President Obama to take a trip to the continent that would highlight how U.S. trade and investment there creates jobs here and further social and economic development in Africa. Lastly, good things are happening in the administration. The U.S. Export Bank, Export-Import Bank, for example, is working to finance a record level of U.S. business exports to Africa, and EXIM has been nimble in matching costs with China's Export-Import Bank. The Millennium Challenge Corporation has also done an admirable job in reaching out to U.S. businesses to ensure that they have the best information possible to participate in the growing number of compacts. What I'm talking to is Ron Brown's recognition that a strong commercial relationship is in the common interest of the U.S. and Africa, and President Clinton's understanding of the importance of a government-wide framework for achieving this goal. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Whitney, and you actually lent back a little bit of time to the audience. The compensation for being a moderator is that I get to ask the first question. And as I listened to the three panelists, I was struck by the fact that a theme that ran through all their remarks, delivered very differently and with very different perspectives, was growth and opportunities is about jobs and incomes. And so what I'd like to ask each of you is if in this world of divided government and sort of somewhat rude political discourse, you were given the golden legislative pen and you were allowed to make one change in AGOA. From the perspective of jobs and incomes, both in Africa and in America, what would be that one change? And you only get the one. So let me start with Whitney.
For me, it's a no-brainer. It would be the zero tax on repatriated income to provide that incentive. And this is important for a lot of reasons. Right now when companies bring back taxes at 35% rate, if it went to zero on Africa, it would increase the return on investment, which is already high. It would lower the risk. But I think more importantly, it would get the attention of those strategic and corporate planners on the corporate boards that would wake up and say something's going on in Africa. So for me, that's it. And the cost, the Peterson Institute has crunched the numbers on this. And we wrote about it in our report on capital flows to Africa. The cost is less than it'd be about $50, $60, $70 million. It's nothing compared to what the returns would be. And that would create jobs. It would create jobs here in the US, it would create jobs in Africa, it would generate disposable income that people could invest in education and give them the discretion to invest where they see fit.
I like to agree. I think that it would certainly be utilizing the tax code to stimulate investments and job creation in Africa, but I would probably take it a little further. I agree with the on income, the tax breaks on income, but I also think that there should be a development tax incentive for U.S. companies like retailers that source products from Africa with significant African content. And those who, in addition to those in investing, develop private sector capacity in Africa. I think there are some creative ways we can utilize our tax code to stimulate investment, and that's the one thing I would do.
It's an excellent question, and I hope that in answering it that I can sort of transcend jurisdictional boundaries a little bit in the Congress, because I think that makes it a little bit harder if it just has to go within the trade committees. But I think that what needs to happen with AGOA is that we need to find a way to really focus on where the opportunities are and how to unlock those opportunities. So somehow we need to take the tool that we have, and I think that Rose is right, that it's a tool that has been really useful and then we need to build on it, but we need to figure out how to make it more targeted. And so that would be, if I were queen, my dream would be to figure out how to really focus in on those things that are not yet happening and to use that tool to unlock the potential. And I think that part of it is about getting government agencies to work together across their silos so that it's not just trade and not just food security and that everything is working together. And part of it, I think, is also opening up trade completely in the products where it's restricted. But focusing in on where those untapped potential opportunities are, I think, is something that we need to really think seriously about. So,
well, now we have about 20 minutes for questions from the audience. What I would propose is to take a group of about four or five questions. If you would be kind enough to keep them fairly short, it would be helpful both to the panel and also to your fellow members of the audience to have the opportunity to ask a second round of questions. So we'll take about four or five questions, go back to the panel, then come back to the audience. And let me just start right here with this gentleman in the front.
My name is Chris Shones. I'm with the Foreign Affairs Center. I'm curious whether anyone ever compares and contrasts Central America's experience under the Caribbean Basin Initiative with Africa's experience under AGOA.
I can't say that I have, but I really think that we should look at that. Yeah. Great idea.
Why don't we try to take a kind of group of questions and then let people come back and sort of pick and choose the ones that they want to answer.
Enthusiastic.
I know you're enthusiastic.
Hi, my name is Bennett Marsh. I want to address the question particularly to Rosa. I thought that this morning's panel got a lot of polite questions and gave very frank answers. I'm not sure my question will be judged as polite as theirs, but I'm still going to ask it. I can't be that brief. This is a printout of the Africa of AGOA as it appears on the government website. It's about 10 pages long. Actually, it's 14 pages long. 90% of the words in that summary are about the textile and apparel provisions. In my other hand, or what would have been my other hand, is the Major Shippers Report released on April 7th by the Commerce Department. I don't understand, in the period of AGOA, how China has been able to increase its exports of textiles and apparel to have reached nearly 50% of world. On that report, I don't see Africa virtually at all. My question is very simple. I don't understand why the AGOA, whether it be the summary or the law, isn't just one page long. Duty-free treatment across the board. Frankly, that's the question I'd like answered. Some of you know I worked on the CBI at the USTR, so I have an attitude.
My name is Deirdre LePin. I'm affiliated with the African Studies Center at the University of Pennsylvania, and I also work as a consultant in corporate responsibility. The last 15, 20 years has seen a sea change in the role of multinational corporations in Africa as what I call donors with a difference. This has been driven, obviously, by their need to create an enabling environment for their business. But these investments that business has been making in not only infrastructure and trading, which is for their core business, have been expanded, encouraged in part by the performance standards of the Equator Principles and IFC and so on, but also have been expanded by local content laws and others to investments that go way beyond core business to the supply chain and to social and environmental and health, education, other forms of investment. Now, business is doing this in large measure for its own interests, but it's also doing it because it's lost patience with local governments. And in addition, it's rather lost patience with our own governments in this country and some in Europe in terms of their support for Africa and its infrastructure and its social and economic development. So I'm wondering how you see the future of support so that business can build business in Africa itself and also how business can partner better with governments, American, European, and others, to help to build small and medium enterprises in Africa and more trade opportunities.
So I have a quick question for Mr. Whitney and Ms. Whitaker. It seems to me that while the U.S. goals and objectives seem for Africa aren't very clarified, when you look at the numbers, much of what the U.S. engagement in Africa is aid, with very little, a very small percentage of that left aside for trade. And as a result, it would seem that a lot of other actors that have had more, such as China, who've had very clear business objectives, their own business objectives, have really taken on much of the business opportunities in Africa. And so how do you see the U.S. moving forward? What is going to be its goals and objectives towards Africa? How could the U.S. clarify that and really start to move maybe some of its aid money into trade and commerce, which I believe is the future for Africa, and that's the kind of engagement that Africa is looking for that's more sustainable? How do you see the Obama administration possibly clarifying that and starting to move towards that direction, and or possibly just increasing some of the trade and commerce engagement and what's invested in that area? Thank you.
Thank you all, and I think we've got quite a range of questions for the panel. I propose just to start on my right with Katrine and work our way down. Feel free to answer any or all, or none.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Well, I was listening to your question about duty-free, quota-free, and thinking that maybe I should amend my answer of queen for a day and just say that's the simplest thing that we could do with the AGOA that would make, I think, an immediate impact, because it would open up trade for products, as I mentioned in my remarks, like sugar, where there still are restrictions, and, you know, would I think, really pack a punch. I do still think, though, that we need to figure out how to make AGOA sort of transcend some of these boundaries, and I think a number of the other questions went to that on linking it to aid, using aid more effectively. We need our aid programs do need to be much, much, much more targeted, and instead of doing some of the things that Rosa, I think, so passionately talked about, which we've all, you know, have seen firsthand and have had frustrations with, we need to have projects that really go to solving a particular problem if they can, or bringing in business expertise. And I think that your point about how to bring business into the chain on this is one that I tried to stress a great deal. Without making the solutions business-focused solutions, I think they just will not work. And so that needs to be where some of these things start instead of where they wind up, you know, much later. These should not just be government initiatives that are between governments. They need to be things that involve the private sector in the conversation all the way through, because what we are talking about, as you say, is creating jobs and creating opportunities in the market. And that's the only way that that's going to happen. So, you know, I thought that Whitney had an interesting suggestion about doing a summit. And I would say that I wholeheartedly support the idea of doing a summit, but I think that the summit needs to involve business as well, instead of just being government to government. And I think that the summit needs to focus on these very specific barriers in the market that can be overcome, whether those are things that governments can do to remove barriers, that African governments can do, that the U.S. government can do, or that business itself can intervene on. And just finally, the development corridors, I think, again, which I mentioned in my remarks, are one interesting way of trying to bring in some of these different business pieces. There are a number of them that are being developed, and we are particularly active on several in Eastern and Southern Africa, on the Southern Agricultural Growth Corridor of Tanzania, going into Zambia, the Central Corridor, several corridors in Mozambique. And one of the things that I think has been particularly interesting about participating in the corridors process, and one of the things that I think that we need to do much more to make that process work, is that it is a forum for business to vet projects and opportunities, for donors also hopefully to have much more tied and targeted aid interventions, and to coordinate amongst themselves instead of being off doing different things and not talking to one another. And I think it needs to be, as we figure out really how to do governance on these corridors, it has to be a way to bring business, small and large, into the discussion, so that you have the kind of effect that you're talking about, where this, you know, the know-how and the expertise of business really comes to the table, but you also have a way of drilling coming back down to what I talked about, which is how do you find these nascent opportunities that are out there in the market that can really have an impact, and an impact on poverty and development, and bring those into the conversation, because I don't think that that's happening enough as it is. So that's hopefully addressing at least a few of the questions.
I think that the second question and a third were very related. One, the Bennett's asked about why do we, in this AGOA era, do we see a surge, I mean, exponential surge, in China's garment exports to the U.S. while Africa's has dwindled? I think that you will see that change around 2005 when the multi-fiber agreement was expired. And that was the agreement that removed quotas on garments and textiles all over the world. That meant that Africa lost 50% of its margin of preference. And we didn't address it very well. We didn't. I would have liked for the U.S. trade representative to have gone into a bilateral textile agreement with China that would have put more restrictions and protected some of those tariff lines where Africa in that sector had demonstrated some competitiveness. So I think that's what it is. And also, the U.S., let's face it, will never subsidize its companies to the level that China is. But there are some things that we can do that we're not doing. And it's not going to come from the government. As long as you all cannot get over the fact that Obama is a popular president and you feel that you cannot criticize him, challenge the policies, ask him to do more, I can tell you, in 10 years, only an African-American U.S. trade representative could, in the Obama administration, could go before Congress and have a trade agenda before Congress and not mention Africa. You all know good and well, if that had been done in a Bush administration, even in a Clinton administration, the activists, we would have been all over that. We would have challenged that. We would have said, where's Africa? And so if they go unchallenged, I support President Obama. I'm a Democrat. I think he's a better president with me challenging him. What's saying Africans are tired of being lectured for less? And so I will continue to say that. So I think that what we can do is that for the Millennium Challenge account, we can use that, for example. Why I couldn't believe in Ghana, our Millennium Challenge account for the road, the George Bush Highway in Ghana, is being constructed by a Chinese company. That's not helping America. That's not building capacity in Africa. And I've told the Millennium Challenge account what we should do. We should have a compact where we have preferences for U.S. companies that partner with African companies, because that's how you build capacity. And you're not going to get development in Africa without a strong private sector. And that they should have preference in those contractings. You can't tell me you couldn't have found the U.S. company and an African company that could do some of these contracts. We're giving those to China. And what we're finding in infrastructure, American companies are not even bidding when they see Chinese companies bid because they know they're subsidized. And so at least in our own programs, and one, that's why Millennium Challenge account has been cut by, I think, over $200 million. It doesn't have a constituency in Congress. It's so counterintuitive. I mean, I've worked for Congress twice. If you want a constituency, you address the concerns. One thing the Congress has said, we cannot vote for something in the future we don't know what it's going to be. So you say Millennium Challenge account. We don't know what countries are going to be selected. We don't know what the compacts are going to be, but we want you to vote. If I were in Congress, I would vote against it too. I can make their life much simple. I would fire some of the people that are working on all these ancillary projects and Millennium Challenge account and say, look, we don't have to guess. We don't need a compact. We know that Africa needs energy, transport, and communications infrastructure. And that is what we're going to do. And that's what the other donors are not doing. That's what we're going to focus on. And all the African countries already have feasibility plans to do that. And that is the single highest cost of doing business in Africa. Without any business, there's no job, there's no development. Simple, make it simple. Then you tell the Congress, that's what you're voting for. We can throw some green technology in there. We'll have preferences for American companies. Therefore, Millennium Challenge account has an American constituency, and quite simple. And I tell you, you'd get a lot of Congress people to support it. But this kind of ideology, you know, kind of going up to Congress, the approach is all wrong. And so I have some other ideas. Ex-Im Bank, Open Bank, OPIC to USTDA. I know you'll touch on that. And I want to agree that most of the engagement has moved away from trade back to aid. But unless we change it, that's the way it's going to go. and we'll continue to have this massive aid industrial complex where the aid is leading the vision in Africa instead of the African vision leading the aid. And if you all are happy with that, that's what we'll have.
Great. Thank you, Rosa. Deirdre, let me go to your point first, because I think it's absolutely critical. You know, it's somewhat of a slogan to say in doing business in Africa, one is doing good and doing well. But there's some reality to that. And I don't think any American company can really be successful in Africa unless it's willing to invest in the communities where they are doing business. And we've seen, you mentioned some of the external codes. I've done a lot of work during the anti-apartheid era on the Sullivan principles. And it was fascinating for me to see where companies took that seriously, they were making a difference on the shop floor. They were integrating the shop floor against the South African law. And, you know, we've seen just a growth of that to today, where you've got companies like SAB Miller and Heineken, which have understood that the market is not so much in hops and barley in producing beer, but it's in sorghum beer. And they're going to get local producers to grow sorghum and get 50,000 farmers. And with that comes health insurance. With that comes education. You know, there are downsides to that, of course. But I think we have to really capture the upside and say, how can we protect it and extend it? And personally, that's where I see so much of the future development in Africa, is the private sector being a catalyst for job creation, development of supply chains, integration into the global economy. Already, private investment far exceeds official development assistance. And that will continue. So I think that's you've hit a really important point. You know, how do you partner with government? I think that's a good question. You know, clearly you have to work with the host government, no question about it. And that becomes a set of challenges in its own right. But I don't think, you know, unfortunately, people really look to the U.S. government to be advocates for investment. Maybe the embassy, maybe the ambassador, but there's no systematic advocacy for American investment. And that goes to Nelly's point, which I think Rosa made, and I certainly tried to convey. Look, the reality is, from my point of view, we're in retreat when it comes to Africa. The U.S., so many programs seem to be going by the boards. You know, we're waiting to understand really what Feed the Future is. How do we measure the impact of that? I don't have the faintest idea. I know that $3 billion have been allocated for it. But I think one of the points that I tried to convey is that we need a senior level champion in the administration advocating for U.S. engagement in Africa. Ideally, it's the president, but if not, certainly one of the cabinet secretaries, and we're missing that. So,
we need to put you back in government.
You know, it's true. I mean, I worked hard for president. I worked hard for President Obama's for Obama's election, and we'll do for the same. You know, because I think he is the best guy out there. But there's no question that it's not happening on the Africa front, and I agree with Rosa. You know, it's up to the people in this room to really not be afraid to make that point, not to be afraid to criticize our own guy if, in fact, you're a Democrat and voted for him.
Mwangi tells me that we have permission to exceed our time limit by about 15 minutes, so I can take one more round of questions. Steve, you had a question back there?
How you doing? Steve Landy, Manchester Trade. Let me put one idea on the table and then ask three specific questions about what we discussed. What this forum has shown has been, both this morning session and this session, that there are a number of ideas out there, and every idea has to be considered, discussed. The idea of having a one-day AGOA forum somehow to take ideas and come up with a policy isn't going to work. So one thing that we have begun pushing recently, discussion with the Africans endorsed by the Kenyan Prime Minister, is to use this forum to launch an honest U.S.-African cooperative effort to work for the next year and try to develop some ideas. And whether those ideas become part of the agenda of the 113th Congress, which is going to reconsider, which is going to have to decide the future of AGOA, whether we end up with an Obama initiative. And let me say one thing to Rosa. I'm a Jewish American. believe it or not. And as far, and I tell you one thing, if we had an American president of Jewish background that did not remember Israel, he would have been hoisted on the petards. So I look at the African Americans and the angry ones, because I can't tell them what to do, and say, hey, guys, you ought to remind him. And he's the only we're the only Western country smart enough to elect somebody who's president who's a son of Africa. Africans haven't been smart enough yet to elect somebody who's a son of America. But we're the only one. So I want to be clear about that. I think it's up to you guys. I can't say you guys. That's a bad word. But I'm trying to say, is this time for us to really argue as a group, we'll say, that we need more? Let me put my three questions on the table very specifically. I love tax incentives. I agree. This may not be a good time to push them because of what's discussed. Could we not accomplish the same thing by using tax treaties where if an African country was given a tax – if an African government gave a tax holiday to a U.S. investment, we would accept what they call the U.N. model of tax treaties, and we would kind of say we won't tax that money either. I don't mind tax incentives. It may be easier to do it in the back door. A question that about negotiating with the East African Community a free trade agreement. I don't have a problem with negotiating an FTA at the right time. I would be very concerned if the U.S. singled out one small wreck as opposed to dealing with the regions, i.e. we're making progress in West Africa where ECOWAS almost has put together a customs union involving French speakers and English speakers. We have a tripartite group which includes Zambia and others. So my only suggestion would be I don't mind a focus on East Africa. They're moving ahead. But don't make the mistake of the economic partnership agreements and begin to choose one section, one group of countries over another. Deal with Africa as a group. So my question is, Abuja Treaty lays out all kinds of goals by 2018. Africa's in many ways ahead of them. Maybe that's when we should begin to think of reciprocity, when we could deal with Africa as a group and so on. And my third question is for Katrin, because she knows trade policy very well. EPAs is the abomination of trade policy. I cannot – well, we've been in trade policy a long year, and the idea of anybody going to a developing country and saying, if you don't open your market because you happen not to be an LDC, which is some silly definition, we're going to deprive access. But where was the U.S.? Why weren't the U.S. saying, excuse me, we don't want to have our items discriminated against. Why didn't we oppose? Because the individual African countries could not resist EPAs. If you're exporting from Ghana, from Kenya, and they say they're cutting off market, you have no choice. So that's the third question I would just pose. Shouldn't the U.S. have a policy where it joins Africans who have been valiantly resisting these EPAs to the extent they can and maybe suggest a more thoughtful process? Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, then we'll go back to the panel, since we are standing between you all and lunch, and conclude on that set of questions from Steve. Whitney.
Okay. Steve, let me just jump into your issues here. In terms of a study, I don't like the word study, but in terms of developing a common framework in 3 to 6 months, I think that makes eminent sense. I mean, I'd very much like to see an outcome of the Goa Forum where Minister Mutare's idea of setting up clear goals for transitioning from reciprocal to from non-reciprocal to reciprocal trade might be put on the table, so we can see the way forward. And if that's an outcome, I think that would be a very welcome outcome of the AGOA Forum. Bits versus tax incentives. You know, the benefit of a tax going to zero tax is that it gets everybody's attention, and it's operational from day one. A bilateral tax treaty has value. Don't get me wrong. It'll take about 2 to 3 or 4 years to negotiate. You know, it gives you the structural benefit, but it's in my view, it's very slow. And as I said earlier, we have to approach the issue of U.S.-African relations, economic development on the continent with a sense of urgency. And that's why I think both, actually, tax incentives in the near term to really stimulate new investment, but really to sort of protect it over time, a bilateral investment treaty would make sense. And, you know, I just singled out the East African community for several reasons. One, it is five nations that are growing well. They've a lot of cooperation. There is a customs union, and I think that would be a good place to start. But left to me, there'd be free trade areas with SADC, COMESA, Central Africa, West Africa, and I think that's what we would like to see, I would imagine, our trade profile with Africa look like over the next 15, 20 years. But we have to get going, and I sense that East Africa might be the place to start.
Well, let me briefly say that I think that the questions are very related around the tax treaties and as well as the EPAs. And I think the operative word is that the economies are asymmetrical. And unless Africa converges more with the world economically, and now is diverging more, the only region of the world getting poorer, I don't think we can talk about economic partnership agreements or tax treaties, because we just advance an inequality gap. Why? It is just disingenuous to say we're going to have a bilateral tax treaty with you, Kenya, since the ambassador is here. And Kenyan companies then can invest in the U.S. and not pay taxes, and then our companies can invest in Kenya and not pay taxes. How many Kenyan companies do you think have the capacity to really, in mass, in a sizable, make the kind of investments in the U.S. that would be equal to what the U.S. companies can do there? I just don't see any reason why we cannot offer tax incentives to our companies to promote private sector capacity and development in Africa on a non-reciprocal basis as a contribution to development. It also would help them in many ways. Secondly, on the economic partnership agreements, it's the same thing. It advances the inequality gap. You know, really, to ask even, you know, countries that are, and I agree with you, Steve, wholeheartedly, this whole development, underdevelopment, you know, I mean, to ask them to sign up to these agreements, and they were forced into it. Many of them can't say it. They were forced. If you have a large part of your economy contingent upon trade with the EU, and they say, unless you sign this, we're going to cut you off, they had to do it. For me, I'll end where I started off. Like Martin Luther King said, there is such a thing as being too late in life and in history. And if we do not mobilize as external stakeholders, it is just not going to happen. I am just surprised at the fact that we don't have a champion in government. If we don't have a champion, we need to find somebody that's halfway eloquent and educate them. I was on the I was in Congress yesterday, all week been in Congress, and I am just really surprised. I brought a group of African health leaders up to talk about the health, you know, budget. And making sure Africa, and the fact that most Americans think that the U.S. is contributing 25% of its budget to foreign affairs when it's really only 1%, that's an external mobilization messaging problem. And the fact that we have so many even new members of Congress that don't have passports, it is up to us. I mean, it is really up to us. We don't have Ron Brown. Let's create that champion before it's too late.
Couldn't agree more that we need a champion, and I do think that we have a real sense of urgency here. Food security is something else that, you know, that again we're seeing a period of food prices that are going up, and again we're in a period where there is a very unstable global economy on food. And what are we doing? I mean, years have gone by since the last food crisis. We're coming around again. And we need to do something. So we need to do something on trade. We need to do something to really address these underlying conditions that are preventing the market from working, or we're going to keep having the same conversation over and over and over again, I think. And I think that's the only way that this is going to change, is if we really get at what is preventing things from moving forward in a serious and significant direction. And so, you know, without a champion, though, I think that it's going to be difficult to do that. I don't know how you create that exactly, but I think that we need to find a way. And perhaps, you know, we look for champions that are in the international system as well to try to make this happen. But To answer Steve's questions on the economic partnership agreements, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think it was clear when I was speaking that I do think that this is the wrong model. I think that we're at a point right now where we're starting to think about what a new model looks like, and I think we need to be careful about that. But the economic partnership agreements are not the way to go. They do distort trade. That is not the intention, and they do lock in preferences for European trade at the expense of everybody else, at the expense of intra-regional African trade, at the expense of trade between Africa and the United States. They were a solution that, was proposed under the guise of WTO inconsistency, which I think was never something that was going to come to the table. And yet, they were pushed forward in a way that was really not, that was just not right. So I do think that the United States should have been out there saying, wait a minute, why is this happening? But I don't even think that people knew that there was a provision in them that said that you could not, that basically you had to give these benefits to European companies at the expense of U.S. Mm-hmm. companies. I don't think anybody knew that. And when that has come up in conversations that I've had with folks in the policymaking community, they've been surprised. So we need to wake up a little bit and start looking at what others are doing, whether it's Europe or China, and find a way that we can have a true relationship with Africa instead of just sort of, being asleep here while everybody else does things that are not optimal and wondering then why we're the ones being left out. So, I mean, I couldn't agree more. We need to, but this is our chance. And if we're going to do it right, we've really got to make sure that we come out with something that shows some strong leadership, and get some of these things right in a way that nobody else has. So, Steve, that I've also been a proponent of thinking about how to take a full regional approach, and it's not an easy thing to do because the way that we tend to engage in these conversations is government to government or government to regional entity, and we don't necessarily have another model. Again, I think the development corridors are a way of getting around that because they are on a market level, they're not on a government level. And if we can figure out how to support the development corridors, we're supporting a lot of the things that the regional economic communities are trying to do, but we're doing it in a way that sort of transcends some of the political boundaries and some of the complications with pushing for some of, for some of these reforms. I mean, for countries that are landlocked, if your neighbor doesn't have the right reforms, you can do everything right and still be in a situation where you're hoping, that things will get unlocked, but you don't have the power to do it. So I think that supporting the corridors and trying to put resources behind them and getting more interest on the company part, which does exist. Again, these are the value chains themselves. So there's real interest on the private sector in doing that. But, looking at how the WTO, for example, can take a regional approach, I think is something, something worthwhile. But the WTO is so slow. So we need a faster and more nimble way of doing this than sort of relying on these traditional models that we've had in the past. I think it really does bear, much more conversation. And I like your idea about taking time and putting together a real group. I also don't like the word study because I think when I hear study, I think, hire a consultant to do study and million-dollar giant project that's going to wind up in somebody's drawer. And that's not what this is about. I think it has to be a real conversation. I think it has to be a live conversation. I think it has to be a conversation with the private sector on where the opportunities are that are not being tapped. So I think that I am all in favor of doing, kind of kicking off some kind of process like that. And I think you could link it to this idea of doing a summit where you really focused on the things that need to be unlocked, and make it all kind of part of where we're heading with this. We want to really take this conversation to a new level and look at what really needs to happen. So I hope that we're all up for the challenge. I think that we are, and I think Rose is right. I was part of the group that fought for extending third country fabric provisions in the past, and I'm sad to hear that we're not out there really beating the drum on this because it's incredibly important, and it's something that if the attention is not brought to these things, they will slip under the radar and then it will be too late. So we've got to really now, I think the challenge before us is how we're all going to work together to come up with something that's going to work better and address all of the things that have come up today. I think it's been a good lively discussion. So hopefully we can continue it, and a year from now we can have a different conversation.
Thank you all. I noticed in the last panel that Mwangi abused his moderatorship by having one random thought. And as the panel was answering the last question, I had one random thought, which is, if you've noticed, there's a lot of energy around the EPAs and AGOA. But the elephant in the room is really the global trading system. And indeed, one thing we haven't talked about today, except very indirectly, is the fact that the growing market for Africa is probably in Asia. If we need leadership in America for America's relationship with Africa, we need leadership globally for Africa's relationship with the global economy. Part of that has to come from Africans themselves, but part of it has to come from their growing market. It would be interesting, and I think useful, and perhaps Mwangi will put it on the agenda for a panel discussion, to talk about, can Asia step forward? Specifically, perhaps, can China step forward and become the champion of a global system of preferences that would really benefit African development and would hopefully work AGOA and the EPAs out of a job? Now, with that said, my random thought for the day, it falls to me only to thank all of you for coming and giving us such a wonderful audience and such a good set of questions, to the panelists for being frank, for being passionate, and since we are in a think tank, most of all, for being thoughtful in their remarks. And we bid you good day.